Hi friends, just a reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be considered medical advice. Also, in this rapidly developing situation, the best source of information on your community and the regulations and recommendations that apply is your local health department. If you're listening to this in the future, first of all, congratulations on being in the future. Second of all, just know that the beginning of 2020 was a complicated time. Now, please enjoy the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA. Hi, and welcome to episode 13 of BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. I'm Andy Walsh, and I'm joined as always by my wife, Jody.
Hi.
And we're back after we took a little break for a couple weeks, and now we're recording again.
Yep.
How are we doing?
I said I wasn't going to be exasperated.
How's that going for you?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm doing fine with, you know, continuing to mostly stay home, but still be able to go out and do some things. I've done some photo sessions, and those have worked well, and you are still working at home.
I work from home, and
you're quite happy with it.
Yep.
We're starting to call our daughter Rapunzel because her hair keeps getting longer and she's not allowed to see anybody.
Yep.
But no, she is getting some social times, but it is getting hard.
Yep.
Yeah. I've been saying, I kind of think it's harder now than it was when we weren't allowed to do anything because the answers then were easy. We just can't do anything. But now it's deciding how to make those choices can be hard. So, do you have any thoughts on?
Yeah, so, you know, we're in an interesting phase of things, both locally and nationally. We're recording this June the 27th, and, you know, we've had already now a couple states decide that they need to pause their reopening programs, and possibly go back.
California was the one. Is it all of California or just parts of California are in bad shape?
There's definitely local parts of California that are seeing more cases. I'm not sure exactly what the regulations are in California. Mm-hmm. I know that Texas and Florida have announced pauses to their reopening plans and possibly even some reversals of rules.
And they're saying these cases that are cropping up, these increases, these aren't just like, this is a nursing home, this is some kind of industry, like an Amazon warehouse, like that's not what we're seeing, are we?
You know, there are still some of those kinds of outbreaks happening in different places, but those aren't the only things that we're seeing. The increases at this time, as reported, are more among like 20 to 40 year olds, or and by like people in their 20s to 40s,
mm-hmm.
are more represented among the new cases of recent weeks than they were in the initial rounds of cases. So some of the new cases, you know, have been investigated epidemiologically, and they've been linked to particular events, you know, a night at a bar, particular gathering, and so we can, you know, make some connections there. I don't know if necessarily every case gets investigated that way. Certainly not every case gets reported about that way, but, you know, the health department doesn't have to disclose every single investigation to the public in that way. And so, yeah, you know, it's consistent with what we understand about the virus, which is that transmission risk increases with proximity and time. The closer you spend next to somebody or in the near vicinity of somebody, and the longer you spend time in proximity to that person, the more likely there is of transmission if one of those two people is infected. You know, masks can have a significant impact on that risk of transmission, particularly if the person who is infected is wearing the mask. And there have been more studies that have confirmed that there's helpful. They're not a guarantee. They're not a guarantee that if you're wearing a mask, especially if it's one of these, you know, homemade masks or surgical style masks, it's not 100% guarantee that you won't get sick. And if a sick person is wearing one of those kinds of masks, it's not 100% guarantee that they won't infect other people, but they do, you know, have significant reductions on the risk of transmission on, you know, 50, 60, 70%, depending on exactly the study that you look at and exactly the conditions of what you're looking at. You know, there's a range, but it's, you know, appreciable. And, you know, the more people that are wearing masks in those kinds of situations, better, because it's not just about my mask is protecting me, it's my mask protects you, and your mask protects me. And so to get the most benefit out of it, everybody has to be wearing one for, you know, for whom it is, you know, feasible. There are some exceptions for that, you know, very young children and so forth, where masks are not appropriate, but generally speaking, if you're able to wear a mask, then that's going to help.
Yeah. So like, for example, you know, I was in Target earlier today and, you know, everybody is wearing masks. Like, I'm wearing my mask when I go into a store, you know, not necessarily to protect me. I'm wearing it to protect the people who work in the store who are there all day. And, you know, yes, they're wearing a mask to make sure the customers that come in, but I'm going to be in there 5 minutes. Well, maybe not for Target, because nobody can just be in there for 5 minutes. But you,
right.
Yeah, I'm in and out. But for if everybody is coming in and out and not wearing a mask,
right? Every interaction is an opportunity for transmission. And, you know, those brief, you know, you pass somebody in an aisle, although, you know, a lot of places have got the one-way aisles and so forth, but you pass, you know, there's the front and flow of the store or whatever. You pass somebody, you know, you're maybe within 5 feet of them. You're certainly not right up next to them. You're not necessarily saying anything to them because you don't know them. You know, so those kinds of very brief, you know, interactions, very low risk of transmission. But, you know, so for individual shoppers, those kinds of retail outings, you know, especially the grocery store and you know, getting those essentials, you know, the risk is low and the trade-off is reasonable because you need those essential goods. But like you say, for the people who work in those stores, it's those low-risk interactions times however many hundreds of people are coming in and out of those stores every day. And so their risk goes up just by that multiplying those, you know, low risk interactions over an extended period of time and over a large number of interactions. And the same thing with, you know, that's why restaurants and bars are different than retail shopping, because there you're spending a long time in closer proximity to the same people. Even if you're not there as part of their party, you're just in closer proximity. You're not moving around as much, and you're sitting for a while. And, you know, practically speaking, you can't wear a mask while you're eating or drinking. Mm-hmm. And so those are just higher risk environments. And so it's consistent with what we understand of the risk factors and how the virus is transmitted, that we would see clusters of outbreaks associated with those kinds of things. That doesn't mean that all, you know, meals out at a restaurant are equally risky. Yeah. It doesn't mean that all, you know, businesses are you know, all restaurants or whatever are doing things inappropriately. You know, a lot of these places are following the guidelines that have been asked of them. And that's good. And, you know, it may very well just be that, you know, we tried this experiment and it may just be that, you know, dining in, even under the conditions that we set up, isn't enough. You know, we need to go back to the, you know, primarily takeout.
I think that's a really, really good point to make. We've never done, I mean, the whole, this is unprecedented. This is still very unprecedented. The idea of closing down so much of our way of life and then slowly reopening it. We're still guinea pigs, like trying to figure out what we can manage, what we can handle, you know, and you know, what, I mean, we have a lot of information that kind of, that is being looked at in order to make these judgments, but you know, we still don't know. I mean, you've said in the past that, you know, when it comes to, you know, predicting humanity, predicting what people are going to do, it's really, really hard to make hard and fast, this is what we need to do.
Right. Human behavior is a big variable in this, and so that makes it challenging to make clear predictions. You know, we can make general rules that, you know, the more people interact with each other, the more time they spend in proximity to each other, the more transmission there's going to be. We can say that as a general, you know, qualitative statement. We can't necessarily quantify exactly how many cases are going to result from a particular arrangement in a restaurant. You know, we can't, the 6-foot rule has to do with how far, you know, the typical droplets spread before they land somewhere. You know, that's where those 6-foot rules come in. But you know, there's some evidence that the virus can actually wind up in particles that are smaller and that therefore travel farther. You know, basically, the bigger the particle, the quicker it's going to land. And so these, you know, these tiny little droplets that are, you know, not even droplets, they're just sort of little mm-hmm. mist particles that you can't even see, you know, can float farther in the air. And so that may be, you know, that may be an issue. That may not be an issue, again, at a retail location where people are moving in and around and, you know, there's high ceilings, you know, a big warehouse style store like Target or whatever, you know, there's a lot of air, you know, airflow and whatnot. But, you know, a restaurant, I don't know. I'm not saying that, you know, we necessarily have to, you know, I'm not making policy decisions. But I'm saying that, you know, that may be the decision that comes out of this is that, you know, that unfortunately even, you know, the sort of distanced or half capacity dine-in restaurant situation may not be feasible.
We, you know, we certainly don't know what's necessarily going to come in the next couple of weeks. I know, I guess, you know, going to like what the numbers have been doing, you know, it's not just, you know, yes, there are certain parts of the country that are, you know, seeing a lot more increase in cases, but it's not just those isolated places. There are other parts that are also, I know, in our area that the numbers have not been doing what you would like them to do. And by you, I mean all of us should want them to do.
Yeah, so, you know, we're seeing a number of states at the state level, you know, in various counties and cities and so forth, are seeing an increase in cases. And, you know, the big question that's been floating around a lot is, well, is that just because we're doing more testing?
I was just going to say that or ask that because that's, you definitely see that floating around on social media a bit.
Yeah. So, you know, we can say a few things about that. One, yes, we have tested more people. We are testing more people per day now than we were a month ago, 2 months ago. You know, there's been a slow but steady increase in the number of tests administered per day, pretty much since we started, you know, any sort of wide-scale testing. You know, it has its ups and downs, but there's a clear upward trend.
It has not been, it's still not, we're still not testing the amount that, like the initial recommendations that.
Yeah, so we've just hit, I think it's 500,000 tests a day nationally is about where we the last couple of days were, if I remember correctly, from what I looked at. And so, yeah, that's, you know, that's short of the, I think 2 million was one number that was put out there. You know, some people have talked about numbers like 20 million. Some people have talked about everybody should get tested every day, and I'm not sure about the,
how that's like the feasibility not really feasible. Of
that. But yeah, there's certainly... We would like to see, you know, from a public health perspective, from an outbreak management perspective, and especially given the number of cases that we're still dealing with in this country, we need to see a greater volume of testing than even that. But it is the case that the number of tests have increased, and there is a certain sense in which, there are certain conditions in which more testing is going to turn up more cases, right? If you only have one test that you can administer, you're going to give it to the person who is most likely to be sick and there's most sick and most likely to be infected or whatever. And so you're probably going to get one case out of that. And then if you have a second test, you're probably going to give it to the next person who's next most likely and next sickest and whatever. And so you're probably going to get another positive result. And now you got two positive, you know, now you have double cases. Mm-hmm. Right. So there is some sense in which there are possibilities for the number of positive results to go up with the number of tests. But that you would expect things to scale in certain kinds of ways in proportion. And that's not exactly what we're seeing. You know, for example, the number of tests nationwide that we're administering has been going up pretty steadily this whole time. But the number of cases hasn't been going up pretty steadily. We had a, you know, initial upswing, and then it leveled off, and then it came down, and then it was pretty flat for quite a while. And if everything was due to more testing, we would expect that that would, you know, keep going up and up as we were doing more testing instead of staying level. We can also look at, you know, individual locations. We talked about like Texas and Florida. I was looking at the test numbers for those states specifically, and the number of tests per day really hasn't changed that much, especially not in the last week or two in which they're seeing this large upswing in cases. So it can't be the case for those specific states that it's more test, you know, that they're just seeing these numbers because of more testing, because frankly, they're not doing that much more testing than they were a month ago. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the other big thing that we can talk about is the number of positive tests or the percentage of positive tests relative to the total number of tests. If it, you know, what you want to be able to see is that number going down and down, because that means that you are exhausting all the possible places that the virus could be. You know, generally speaking, the virus is in people, right? Yes, there's some potential for environmental transmission on a small time scale. But, you know, that's on the order of a day or a couple of days that the virus might be sitting on a surface, whereas the virus can be in people for weeks. Yeah, so cleaning, washing hands, all those things are important to cut down on transmission. But if we really want to get rid of the virus, we got to get rid of it from people. And so if we see that the percentage of positive tests is going down as we test more and more people, that means we're kind of exploring all the possible people that it could be hiding in and getting those numbers down. If we see that percentage is going up, that's indicative of, you know, the spread of transmission. And so, you know, as we were seeing, and what we're seeing is that nationwide, you know, that percentage was going down and down for quite a while. And then, you know, about 10 days, 2 weeks ago, something like that, it kind of hit a low point and then started to creep back up again. And it's been creeping up for a while. And in some of these individual states, like Texas and Florida and South Carolina, it started heading back up several weeks ago.
Yeah.
And so, you know, now they're at levels, in some of these places, they're at levels 10-15% of the tests are coming back positive. What we want to see, the threshold that's been established is about 3% or lower. The places where, like South Korea and Germany, I believe, where they have been able to control the virus, the spread of the virus, by doing lots of testing and lots of, you know, contact tracing and that sort of thing, and not as much in the lockdowns. In those places, they have, you know, been able to, they've reached a threshold of about 3% or lower for the number percentage of positive tests. And so that's what, you know, that's been kind of established as a good target. And so 10 or 15% of all tests coming back positive is quite above that, and suggests an outbreak that is not fully under control and an outbreak that is not fully understood in terms of where it is. If you're finding that many new cases everywhere you look, that means that there are that many more new cases.
Well, and this is still, like with the testing, this is still primarily people coming in and seeking out tests because they either think they've been exposed or they are feeling sick. This isn't just general, like, health departments going and randomly testing, from what I understand.
Yeah, I haven't seen reports of many large-scale random surveys like that. There may be some going on, and there are some differences. You know, for example, locally, as things started to reopen and the hospital started to accept scheduled surgeries and things like that, things that were not emergency medical procedures. They started to test everybody who was coming in for a scheduled mm-hmm. procedure, whether they had symptoms or not. And so, that's an increase in testing, and that's going to start to find some more of these milder or asymptomatic cases because they're getting tested for something other than, I think I have the disease and the virus. And so there is going to be some amount of finding more of those mild cases, the more of that kind of testing we do. But I don't see much evidence that nationally we're doing a lot of that testing on a big scale.
Would that be something that like the state health departments would kind of initialize, just because I know nationally we're not really, we'll just set that part aside.
Our public health system in this country is not organized at a national level. Yeah.
So like at a statewide level, could you see like, I guess I'm wondering if since New York really seems to have gotten things under control after being hit so hard, and you might not have investigated this, are they doing more like of a random testing type of
like I said, system? I haven't seen reports of that. I wouldn't be surprised if there were some of that. I've seen indications of plans and a need for that and people talking about doing that, but I haven't seen reports of the results of things like that, and maybe I missed it because there's always a lot of new things coming out. But yeah, I haven't seen, but yeah, if I were at the New York City Health Department, now that their case numbers are pretty small in terms of number of new cases per day, but not zero and not necessarily all these places, both states and cities here in the U.S. and countries nationwide, countries worldwide, you see a lot of these curves that, they go up, they come down, and then they kind of level off at a place that's not quite zero, but they can't seem to quite get all the way down to zero, but they're not necessarily coming back up again. And, and in some cases, it's still kind of early to say, there's still certainly the risk for it to come back up again, and so it's hard to say what's going to happen in the future. But if I were, at the New York City Public Health Department, we had the funds and the resources and there were, the test kits available and all that, and those are certainly limiting factors, is just the number of test kits that are available and the cost and so forth. But, I would certainly be thinking about, let's do some kind of systematic testing to try to find where are these pockets of transmission that are still happening that we can't quite get taken care of through the social distancing and the stay at home that have been in place and through the contact tracing, whatever that has been put in place. And, especially, for New York City, they're still kind of recently hitting that part of the curve of that sort of flat level. And so it may very well be that they can still get it down to zero or get it down further from where they are without having to do that kind of wide scale random testing or systematic testing. But I would definitely think about that. That was something that they were doing in South Korea and as far as I know still are, and possibly some other places. And so, globally that's a strategy that some places have employed and it's a useful one. But it does require a level of testing capacity and to a certain extent a level of things aren't all on fire, and so we have to take mm-hmm. care, put all of our efforts into just dealing with the people who are sick and need that attention.
So we covered masks.
Mm-hmm.
Covered masks.
Uh-huh.
We've talked about testing. I'm gonna surprise you. What do you think? I don't know if you research this because we didn't kind of mention this when we were kind of talking about what we were going to talk about. How do we be like New Zealand? And are they still on top of not having any cases?
Yeah, so New Zealand seems to be the one place where they were able to get down to that level of no new cases. And so as of the last time that I saw, there were no locally transmitted cases of COVID-19 in New Zealand. There may still be some international visitors or travelers who have brought it from other places, And so they may still be reporting new cases from time to time. But in terms of, you know, local transmission within country, they were down to none. And all of their active cases had resolved, right? So it's not that there are people in the hospital still. Everybody who lives in New Zealand is, you know, and didn't just recently come from somewhere else, is free of infection as far as anybody can tell. How did they get there? You know, a big part of that is they're New Zealand, right? They're physically isolated from much of the world. They don't get as much international travel as a place like New York City. What there is comes in through fewer channels. And so, you know, they were able to catch things early, shut down early before things got really high, and then just kind of keep with it. I don't have more specifics on the...
I would still think that's kind of impressive because, yes, they're isolated, but they're still, their proximity to Asia, where a lot of this is thought to have kind of originated. And my understanding is in that part of the world, there is a lot more, you know, travel between those countries. I don't know necessarily how many are going to New Zealand or if, like, Australia is a bigger destination. But I still think that's still pretty impressive.
Yeah, but yes, it is definitely good for them. I think, it's also whatever normal amounts of travel, it's still, that's a thing you can control and stop. And, the idea of testing people at the airport and checking, checking for fevers and things, like that's only going to get you so far if you're continuing to let people come in, because as we now know, especially that how much asymptomatic transmission is possible, the fact that somebody doesn't have a fever when they land at the airport from somewhere else doesn't tell you the whole story that you want to know. I don't know the details of to what extent New Zealand just completely shut down travel from other places and for how long, but yeah, I think that their successes has something to do with the fact that they are a little bit more isolated and able to have a little bit more control over how many people are coming in and out than a country like the United States, where there's just, that much more international travel. There's, large land borders and so forth.
So we've talked about, masks, we've talked about testing. Has there been any improvement on, or any, headway made on, treatments? And can go into, the vaccine progress as well.
Right. So,
I think I heard that they said again that the
hydroxychloroquine.
I'm never going to get that right.
Well, we probably won't have to talk about it much longer.
It's definitely not helpful.
The FDA has withdrawn some of the provisions that allowed it to be prescribed for COVID-19. So there are specific mechanisms that allow you to use a drug that has gone through clinical testing for one disease to be used for another disease without having to go through all the clinical trials again. Things like compassionate exemptions and things like that, where we know this person is really sick, we don't really have any other options, let's try this medication. So it's not exactly the same as having gone through the clinical trials, but it's also not like we're just giving people random things. We know the safety profiles of them from other clinical trials, and it's more the efficacy that's uncertain. And so they had made allowances for that because there was some reason to think that it was helpful, but they withdrawn those exemptions or those avenues, or at least some of them. As I understand it, the NIH has suspended their clinical trial of hydroxychloroquine. And that's something, that's part of the bioethics of these clinical trials, is basically you can do these clinical trials ethically by saying, we're going to give some people a drug and not give some people the drug. And, you know, ethically, we can do that because we are genuinely uncertain as to which option is better, right? Ethically, it's kind of iffy to say, well, we're only going to give some people a treatment that we know works, right? That's not what a position we want to be in. But with these new drugs, we don't know if it's going to work or not. So our knowledge of which treatment is more helpful is incomplete. And so that's sort of the ethics behind, very simple summary of the ethics behind it. And so something that is developed over time is to try to do these studies as ethically as possible, sort of checking in periodically on is it working? Are we seeing negative consequences of a particular treatment and so forth? And so, as I understand it, as part of that review, and based on other things that have been reported elsewhere, the NIH has suspended that particular part of their clinical trials for this. So it doesn't look like the hydroxychloroquine is going to be, you know, part of the conversation for much longer. Unless, I don't know about these hydroxychloroquine plus zinc trials, if they were suspended as part of that. That might still be ongoing because there was a little bit more, and, you know, there were some mechanistic reasons to understand a little bit better why that might be helpful and so forth. So we'll see if that combination is still under investigation or not. So that treatment has not looked particularly promising anymore. But one thing that came out that was positive was a steroid called dexamethasone that was found to be helpful in treating the cytokine storm and the inflammation that results from or during severe illness, severe COVID-19. So this is not an antiviral. It's not doing anything to stop the virus from spreading inside your body, and it's not doing anything to stop you from, you know, infecting somebody else. What it is doing is reducing the chances that if you get COVID-19, that you die from it because of this severe cytokine storm immune response.
And that's where your immune system doesn't turn off, basically. It just keeps
right. It just keeps revving up and revving up.
And you know,
attacking, and does damage to your own
attacking systems. Healthy part of your body.
Yep. Yeah. And so that's where this drug seems to be helpful in reducing mortality. That said, it is also, you know, it comes with its own risks. Like hydroxychloroquine, it is not a perfectly innocuous drug. There's a reason why we don't sell it over the counter at, you know, the grocery store or the drugstore. It needs to be administered under physician's care by prescription because there are some risks associated with it. And so it's not for, you know, everybody and anybody who has COVID-19. It's for these patients who are...
And this is not like... I just know of you know, you have bad infections, sometimes they'll give you a steroid to kind of help, like, with pneumonias, and this isn't, like, steroid is a general term for a whole category of these, and this is a type of steroid.
Right, this is one specific compound in the class of drugs called steroids, that's right. Yep. So that's good news for people who are seriously ill from COVID-19. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't do everything we can to reduce transmission, you know, because there are still limits on how much of this drug is around. And there are already reports of shortages of this drug because of the demand by COVID-19 patients or doctors treating COVID-19 patients. And, you know, we can still overwhelm the hospital system. You know, this is not here, take this pill and 12 hours later you're back on the street and just fine. You know, if we have lots of people who are seriously ill, we can still overcrowd the hospitals and have worse outcomes because not everybody can get this drug and not everybody, you know, has even room in the hospital to be treated with the drug and so forth. So we still want to take all the steps to reduce transmission that we can, because this isn't this isn't a cure-all. This is a positive treatment for a specific group of people.
This could really help in managing the number of people who could potentially die from this.
That's the hope, is that it will reduce the mortality from it. Right, but even then, you know, there seem to be some long-term, you know, consequences of having had a severe case of COVID-19, maybe even a moderate case of
that stuff. We're still even learning because, you know, we only know
there's only a few people in the world who have had this disease or have you know, lived for 6 months after having the disease.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's still going to be a lot to learn about the long term, but you know, it is good to see some good things. I did also see, I don't have as many details, but I did also see that there were some positive results treating blood clots. You know, that's another issue that has come up in some patients is generating a lot of blood clots, and that's causing, you know, secondary illnesses and problems. And so, you know, there seem to be some options for managing that as well. So, you know, we are learning things and we are able to help some patients.
Would the clotting, would that happen as part of that cytokine storm, or is that just something, I guess I'm kind of curious as to what is going on, like, within your circulatory system that it starts clotting?
Right. So I don't know that we know for sure yet. So it's a kind of hard test to do because it's things going on inside the body of living people. And so, you know, if you need to kind of develop an animal model or something like that, or, you know, there's some tests that you can do on people, but, yeah. So as far as I know, we don't have a complete answer for that. One possibility is just sort of the general inflammatory response. The possibility is that there are cells in your blood vessels that express the ACE2 protein that is the receptor for this virus that allows the virus to get into your cells. And so the virus may be infecting cells in your circulatory system directly.
Okay.
And that may be leading to the blood clots as the immune system responds in a targeted way to those localized infections in the circulatory system that might generate conditions for creating a blood clot. How does a virus get into your blood vessels? Possibly, you know, presumably through a respiratory infection, and then it crossed, you know, at some point it got deep into your lungs and crossed over.
Mm-hmm.
Deep in your lungs, there are, you know, very thin layers of cells between the outside air and your blood vessels, and that's how the oxygen gets in and the carbon dioxide gets out for your lungs to do what they need to do. But that also may mean that it doesn't take very much for the virus to get from one side to the other. So those are the kind of the options that are being investigated for how those blood clots are forming.
Any word on vaccine? I heard Dr. Fauci was having high hopes.
I don't know if you would say like, high hopes, but he's, you know, guardedly optimistic.
End of the year, early next year.
Yeah, I don't think we've hit any new milestones since the last time we talked about it. There are still, you know, a couple of vaccines in the phase 2 clinical trials. So that's the giving it to on the order of 100 or a couple hundred people to see both if it is protective and to see if it does not cause safety concerns. There have been a couple of instances where a vaccine was found at that kind of stage of testing to actually make the disease worse because it kind of primes your immune system, but doesn't in a way that allows it to overreact, but not completely clear a subsequent infection. And so because we know that's a possibility with any kind of vaccine for any virus, it's a concern here. And so that's something that we want to see not happening as part of these phase 2 clinical trials. That's something that's looking for us to make sure that that's not the case. And then also to make sure that having gotten the vaccine, people are less likely to get infected, or if not that, less likely to spread infection to other people. And then depending on that, we'll see if it goes to, you know, if any candidates go to phase 3 trials. And then, you know, so there's a couple that are in those phase 2 trials, or a bunch more that are in phase 1 trials or preclinical testing. And so, yeah, there's lots of irons in the fire. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's, you know, like I think I've said before, if there is a vaccine for this virus, it is almost certain that among the over 200 candidates that have been, you know, floated and are in various stages of testing, that it's one of them, yeah, or more than one of them. Ideally, more than one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it seems unlikely to me that if it is possible to make an effective vaccine against this virus, that we haven't already made it.
So when we talk about, just out of curiosity, when we talk about the progress and moving forwards,
are we talking about one specific, like, are we talking about the one being developed in the United States, or are we talking, like, globally, everybody's kind of pooling things?
Right. Together? So that over 200 candidates is a global figure. As far as I know, there is one candidate in that is going through phase two testing in the United States. And there is one candidate that was developed in China that is going through their process. I'm not sure if they have exactly the same, but they obviously have to test for the same kinds of things. And so, you know, and then there are other, you know, the UK has a vaccine candidate that they announced was going into sort of a hybrid testing that they expect to have results from. You know, when they announced it, they expected phase three type results by October. I'm not sure exactly if that's still on track for that result. So we're not necessarily talking about one, you know, and we're, nobody's, you know, putting their hopes in just one vaccine. We're testing all of them in various stages. The federal government has chosen five candidates, including that one that's in that phase two trial, for it, what they call the Warp Speed project, which is basically saying that the government is going to put money into these things where normally we would let these companies that are developing them to incur more of the cost.
Yeah.
But we're saying, look, it's important enough to us to have a vaccine as soon as possible that we're going to put money both into the clinical trials and if and when it's appropriate, into mass manufacturing so that we can have as many doses as possible, as quickly as possible. But there is an open question of, well, what happens if China has an effective vaccine first? Or what happens if the United States has an effective vaccine first? Or what happens if this UK one comes first? Or whichever country, wherever, Germany, whomever, you know, will they license it? Will it be possible to manufacture enough doses? You know, what are the supplies that are involved? I think probably our best bet, even though it might mean that we have some weird gap, you know, some weird overlapping times where one country or one region has a vaccine before other places, I think in the long run, their best bet is going to be for several of these candidates to turn out to be effective and that they're different enough that the manufacturing of large numbers of doses depends on different resources so that we can scale up several of them in parallel. Because, you know, what you don't want to see is, well, we have three or four different vaccines, but they all require the same needle or whatever. And so it's the same as if we just had the one kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's not like something, that's not something we can necessarily prepare for right now because...
Right, because we don't know which one. Right, and they have, and, you know, they are trying a variety of different kinds of processes in part to avoid those kind of bottlenecks. Right, so the one that's in phase two trials is an RNA vaccine. So what they're injecting into you is RNA suspended in a little drop of oil, basically. That's very different from giving a whole virus kind of vaccine. So it has a different manufacturing pipeline. You know, the University of Pittsburgh is developing a vaccine candidate that uses microneedles instead of an injection. And so it's more like it's more like a Nicoderm patch, or, you know, like that kind of thing. It's a bandage you put on. It's a bunch of little tiny things that kind of break off and dissolve rather than one metal needle injection. And so, so that has a different manufacturing pipeline. So ideally, several of these different styles of vaccines will work out so that we can scale them up in parallel and not be in a situation where we're just kind of, where we know we have the solution, but we're waiting to have enough of it to give out. And I don't know what we're going to do, you know, if it's a matter of we will wait until there's enough for everybody and then give everybody their vaccine, or if we'll kind of lottery out the, you know, batches of doses as we have them, or what. That's an interesting,
hopefully
we're not really in those kinds of situations. You know, and I think that's part of what this Warp Speed project is trying to avoid is that once we get those phase 3 clinical trial results, that we're already well on to the manufacturing mm-hmm. process. And so we're not going to be having to ask those questions, but it remains to be seen how all that will play out.
I think I've kind of decided that I don't necessarily like living history.
I mean, we all do it all the time.
I'm perfectly ready to go back to the precedent times. As opposed to these unprecedented.
That's fair.
Yep. I think we've probably covered quite a lot.
I think so.
After being on a break for a little bit.
Yeah. So, I hope that there's helpful information in there. I hope that everybody feels like, like I said, the human behavior is still a big variable, which means that we have a lot of control over what happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can still be out. We can still have, somewhat of a normal life, but we need to remember that the virus is still out there and it's still transmitting. And so, wear your mask, wash your hands, don't touch your face. And if you are perfectly content to stay home, then stay home.
That all sounds pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks. And we'll talk to you next time.